device is not carrying, we recommend that you turn off your electronic equipment and simply hold off on anything you do with it until after the meeting. Would like to comment. A lovely Sunday morning, and fortunately this year the city did let everybody know about the bicycle race that generally ties up traffic. Coming in years going by, you couldn't move on Walnut Street this time of the day or any of the side streets because of the bicycle race. That said and done, we would like to remind you that we're here to spread broadcast the teachings of Theosophy as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. We hold two weekly meetings of every weekend. As you can see, Sunday morning we open promptly at 11, and you could get in the building at 10:30. Wednesdays, building opens at 5:30. There's always a volunteer present in the library to introduce you to our stack of books, literature, pamphlets, and so forth. And there you may find out what the topic will be for that evening. In the present time, we're in the Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge, and we're toward the end of the little book that's so important during the course of our studies. Library closes at 7:30, which means you have half an hour until the meeting, 15 minutes until the meeting begins, during which time you can take a look at the desk where you'll find another volunteer explaining literature or any other ideas or any questions you might ask. At 7:45, promptly, the meeting begins for the ocean class that evening, and it's over at 9 o'clock. You will find on the back the Declaration of the ULT, and if you would like to understand who the people are that present these ideas to you, we're all volunteers. And at the top it says, the activities in these rooms depend on voluntary offerings in time and work. Everyone is invited to participate, but no obligation is imposed or implied. Before meetings and after meetings, you can make more inquiries on that topic because it's a definite way that you can apply to help on in this work. The Declaration of the ULT explains very briefly and pointedly to what the group engages in. And on the back, you're going to see a list of other lodges of the similar, same thing, do the same thing all over the world. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It's loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but doesn't concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. This morning, our topic for June the 3rd, a truer realization of the self. A reading from the writings of Robert Crosby. Each one of us knows who in 1909 really resuscitated the Theosophical movement in the United States. And here it is, 2012, a new century, and we're still active. May we continue. Man, the invisible being, eternally is. For him, there's never for an instant cessation of consciousness. The curtain rings down on one scene to immediately rise on another. When the body is at rest, the man is still acting and thinking, in another way, in a finer form, on planes not so restricted as is the physical plane. There he has freedom. There he sees and feels and hears and speaks and acts, as he does on the physical plane, but he can be here, there, or elsewhere. Wherever his thought brings him, wherever his desire is, he can move freely and unhampered by gross physical material. The power of perception of all kinds of substance and of all kinds of beings is the power of every one of us. But that power to see lies behind the physical eye. It belongs to the eye within. The eye of the soul.
Which is in itself the self. As students of this philosophy, we need to take the effort and the time and put it forth on our own. And as it states, that idea, realization, in the dictionary it says, bringing into existence the self. And when we speak of the self, as we will during the course of the meeting, we have the self, with a capital S. We see and think we are the self with a small s. So we would think the first thing that every one of us would have to do is to take an honest inventory of their subjective possessions, good, bad, or indifferent. And it seems that each one of us and those throughout the world, we have a tendency to imprison ourselves in narrow grooves. And we think that the others are limited in their personal views. So what is much needed, not just for us as students, but for the individual and also for a nation, is a larger altruism must be submitted for the limited personal views. We sometimes think we understand it. There are other times we're not quite sure what it means to have a realization of the self. There are hints that are given all the way through, not only of HPB's Robert Crosby, but William Q. Judge, on how we should think and how we should act. So how, if we use the idea of how we should think, how we should practice this idea of altruism. And it's only as we think and act from that basis should we be really able to reach these finest perfected truths that have been a part of humanity since the beginning of this planet and prior. There is a way and means to realizing these truths. So they tell us how we seek, let's seek for universal ideas, dwelling on that which is immortal and changeless and limitless, which is our very self and the self of all creatures. It's through this process of ways of thinking and acting that the realization will come little by little. But we are told it will surely come. Now, these universal ideas, such ideas alone are true, but there's always and ever that universal that remains true to everyone and to all times. So in that statement, how one should look at it as a student of the philosophy, it's for us to understand and to see that we need to think right, we need to build right, and we need to build upon a strong foundation of truths. And that if we keep our eyes on the path of the great masters of wisdom who have gone before and are still active now, that we will have it open to us in time. And it's a statement that they make that we can understand even at this point at the beginning. As we help others, we truly help ourselves. And as we help ourselves by helping others, we raise all. So that is the deepest part of it. They give us three great ideas to meditate upon. And if we keep these three in mind and use them during times of meditation, it'll help us get a greater depth. It tells us the soul of man is immortal and its future is the future of a thing whose growth has no limits. That's something to ponder upon. The principle which gives life dwells in us and without us, is undying and eternally beneficent. It's not heard or seen or smelled, but is perceived by the man who desires perception. And the third one, each man is his own absolute lawgiver. the dispenser of glory or gloom, to himself, the decree of his own life, his rewards or his punishment. So, if we look at the idea of what happens from life to life, because part of the ancient teachings are the idea of reincarnation and karma. And just briefly, when the new self, shall we say, during a new beginning of a rebirth, we have to understand there's a part of our nature that is the individual, that same individuality as before, but not the same personality in this new life that we're going to take. And we are reaping the consequences of one's own actions and thoughts in previous lives. So that if we understand what we physically see within the mirror is one thing, and what we physically think is another, but we need to pull away from that physical, personal nature that is so imbued in us, that comes with what we call the human soul, this physical body and all the substances. And it brings us to the idea of the sevenfold nature of man. We're going to deal primarily today only with the triangle, that upper triangle that we speak of, that Atma, Buddhi, Manas. And yet, this lower personal nature deals with and assumes within most of it the four lower qualities, but and the principles of man. So if we take that part and understand it, we're really seeing that eternal part of our nature, our permanent part of our nature. And yet, once it enters into a human form, we become dual, and that's the monastic, the thinker. We are thinkers. If we look at it, it's one, it's a principle, but it's also what is individually factual, that we are thinkers. We use the brain in each new life as best we can. And that brain in this new life has no memory of anything that's happened in previous lives. But that thinker knows when it touches that other quality, which we speak of as the Buddhi. That's really the vehicle, the holder, and the direct emanation, we could say, from that first part, the spirit. So it's not an individual property at all. So when we think of the three, the Atma, Buddhi, Manas, and put it all together, we can see that Atma, looking at it as the higher self, is only when the thinker joins in with his and taps in with his Buddhi, so it becomes Buddhi Manas. Because that Buddhi carries all the information and all previous ways of living and thinking within it, and we can tap it within. There is no need technically to look without, to a book, to a saying, to a teacher. In a way, we have to look within, it states. And so this activity that we need to think and give is one of, in a way, controlling that lower nature. So it can be like a funnel that we can open up and let our truer self come across. And we do feel it every once in a while. Each one of us has, in its way, its own karmic destiny. Whether we let our mind, the Manas principle, gravitate downward to the seat of the animal passions, or upward to the Buddhi, the spiritual ego. We have different things that we can see, that, for instance, that we are bound by our choices. We found a thing from Mr. Judge where it says, free will is an active aspect of karma. Fate is the passive aspect. Now, each one of us possess the will, which is free. We are free to choose, and we're free to determine. But once having made our choice and our determination, we are no more free. We are bound by our choice and by our determination. We take the idea of eating something we're eating. There are times when you can eat something that tastes good, feels good. It's not necessarily good for you. You're going to have a bad effect for it. But on the other hand, if you're conscientious in thinking of it, you can try for a more healthy thing. So depending how we look at it, let's talk about relationships. There are some relationships that are short, that is like passing in the night. There are other relationships that we make with others that are eternal. They just go on and on. They're your old friends, your old buddies. So whatever we're bound to reap, we will also the harvest of our own sowing. So in any of these ideas, the same idea of planting a seed, depending on what type of a seed you plant is going to express what's going to come from it, what flower is going to bloom from it. But we must understand to give the attention to it at the same time. So we can understand within our own nature, there is a higher part. There is a part of our nature that doesn't always concern itself with me, I, what I want, what I need. There is a part of our nature that wants to be more of a giving type person rather than worrying so much about ourselves. Many times we find these little ideas cropping up. We found many quotes, which we won't go into all of them, but we do want to remind you, as it states in the Three Fundamentals and also from the Secret Doctrine, there is a pivotal doctrine that admits no privileges, no special gifts in man, save those won by his own ego through personal effort and merit throughout long series of incarnations. That is one there. The Buddha's teaching, difference between the personal temporary ego and the higher self, which sheds its light on the imperishable ego, the spiritual eye of man. We have all this within us, and even the poet Shelley had said, nothing in the world is single, all things by law divine, in one spirit meets and mingles. So the one law of life that binds the entire universe. So we can use that whole idea of looking and having this realization that there is something more than this personality, this quote, creature that we see when we look in the mirror, that we know there are times we've had glimmers of what it's like to really be altruistic, to just do something because it's there to be done, without patting me on the back, without letting me know. I know it's a good feeling within when we do this. And for some, we're not quite sure. For others, we're in a way not sure, are we doing the right thing or we're not doing the right thing. But the main thing is, the idea is, are we doing? Are we trying to put the effort through to understand what it really means to be something of a help? Something, and if we understand this idea, it's so true that when we help others in a very inner way, we're helping ourselves. it takes some discretion. It might take for some of us constant reminders. For others, we just go through it. For some, it's a true battle, as in the Gita, with that Arjuna and Krishna, that constant trying to get to understand it, to know it, to do it. But the idea is that there is no limits to it. Once someone starts questioning, if we keep questioning, the answers will come. And they state, when we look around us and look through history, and we speak of these great masters of wisdom, if we think of people like the Buddha, like Krishna, like the Christ, we all have that Christ within us. We need to be able to let it shine through, because it had to have been more than one lifetime that these great masters put this effort forth and had that concentration to be a help to all mankind. It's just for us in little ways, once we learn to do a certain thing and we have others, we want to show them, this is how it's done. I have done it. I understand it. We won't know till we put our foot in the water, as it states. But the fact of the matter is, there is a different way of living than for most of us that we live right now. And maybe for some of us, we have it every so often. Maybe some of us have it more often than others. But the fact that each one of us, thinking about it, we have had a touch of that higher true nature that we are. And as it states, especially in the process of when we go to sleep at night and dream and go past the dreaming state, where we're actually free on our own plane. There is no physical matter to bother. There's no objects bothering us. It's pure bliss in a way. That is a feeling that one could have on a daily routine, whether it be watching a sunrise or a sunset. One can have that feeling of pure bliss and calmness within him once we start to think and approach and gravitate towards our truer, higher self. So hopefully we will have some questions on this subject matter. Yes?
We got in touch with the idea you were talking about with planting the seed, but making the conditions right. Because we know if we plant a seed and put the pot in the closet, it's not going to bloom. But given water and light and so forth, and we remembered a story we heard where experimenter scientists went into a cave and there was an area they wanted to study, so they set up lights, huge, bright, warm lights. And within a day or two, the cave had started to grow green everywhere because the conditions were right, and they were shocked. So it would seem that we need to be our own gardeners, and within the karma that we have created and find ourselves, we can still make the conditions right to till that soil and go through our minds, it was said, discriminate, get rid of the weeds and so forth, and begin to blossom where we are.
Very much so. That is a good comment, because there's no limit, nor is there a limit of time. And the fact that no matter how many times we fall or slip or slide, we can get up and keep trying again, and eventually it's going to become a habit, and it's going to automatically fall into place. Right now, we have to set up, shall we say, set up the ground for us to put our seeds in. Yes?
I keep getting caught up in this idea of the higher self, the big S, you know, and in some of my readings outside of the theosophical stuff, you know, they talk about how, you know, this is a community higher self, and that it's not an individual. It's not like the big S. My big S is the same as your big S. And, you know, people like Krishnamurti and Harding, they don't believe in this reincarnation thing. And, you know, it was a very comfortable place for me to believe in reincarnation. I really liked it, and it felt comfortable. And then I hear this other stuff, which basically stirs up all this, you know, this comfort. And, you know, I don't know what the truth is, but, you know, the whole idea is my higher self the same entity as your higher self, or is there truly an individual component of the big S, or is the big S just this collective?
We could, is the big S just collectively? If we look at that first idea, that spiritual Atma, that really it's only the one, and there's two aspects that we can look at, and that is, we said, there is a part in our nature that we know when something's right or wrong. We don't need to be told. Certain situations, we just know it. That comes from that booty, that storehouse. And if we look at the idea, whether it be an athlete or whether it be an artist, whether it be a musician, we know you have to put effort forth. So eventually something will come of it. So if we look at the idea that any one person in any one lifetime has certain tendencies, has certain characteristics. The characteristics that we know about ourselves can sort of let us know what we've been through, what we know, and what we don't know. We can't honestly say this idea of reincarnation and karma seems the most logical explanation for why we have things like geniuses, for why people can pick up something and just know it. Where did it come from? We know nothing comes from nothing. You have to put effort forth to have something be expressed. So we're thinking that if one thinks about it, when we start studying these ancient teachings, and one of the first things that we find out is, man, the thinking being has been around for over 18 million years. And it's like, how is this possible? It is very possible when we think about it, because we have been gathering things. There, we have the pro and the cons. They're all in our own makeup. Yes, in the behind?
Could we, perhaps, with respect to the last question, could we investigate what HPB implies when she writes the words self three different ways? One, it's all smalls, one with a cap S and small ELF, and then she'll also sometimes write it all caps. What is she differentiating between those three uses of the word self?
It would seem our understanding of those three uses. The one that we're most commonly, for most of us, is that small self that lives on this physical, material plane. Then we have the other, which is this that we're speaking within us that really does touch upon the higher. And then where our understanding is that all caps is the self of all. If we look at the aspect of, we weren't put here by a being. We have evolved, but we're all part of that all-encompassing one source. And that's our understanding of the three. Yes?
Well, like anything in theosophy, the same thing can be said many different ways.
True.
And so could we say that all the self, all small, is like a spark, and it's our own personal self, but it's a spark, and that the higher self is that spark inflamed, or one of the sparks of the divine, that flaming fire, which is the self of all, that because we're all rays of one.
Right.
So there are those that there's just a spark there, but they don't see that they have a flame within them, that they have this power, that we are divine. We're not looking at the soul as being something that can be taken away and outside of ourselves. We are soul, all is soul. We're sparks of the divine, then we're the flame, and then there's the huge conflagration, maybe, the atomic ray that is really everywhere and in everything, but we have not realized that full consciousness yet.
So true, yes. Behind.
If we accept an idea as eternal, we understand that to be something, an eternality, an endurance. If we imagine that the self in all caps is that eternal duration, then its periodic radiation, which is the capital S, is reincarnating because it is part of that eternal. And each time it reincarnates, it needs a vehicle, which is the small s, which is still imbued with spirit but doesn't realize it. We imagine we are just these clothes and this hair and these bodies, but we don't realize the eternal is within us, and being a spark of that eternal, it must continue. So reincarnation then becomes a natural course of evolution.
Yes.
Just to return to something you said previously, you said that part of the reason you believe in reincarnation is that the reason we have geniuses. How much of what we're talking about has to do with intelligence? Like, is the different selves experiencing them, is that also experiencing a difference in a personal intelligence?
It would seem that yes, very much so. There are natives that live on islands that are, not visited too often by, quote, highly civilized people, that live closer and are more imbued with an altruistic lifestyle, with a universal lifestyle, that take after each other. There's no, I want this for myself. There is a sharing, there is a knowing. So just because we're saying highly civilized intellectuals doesn't mean that they are imbued with the pure beauty of giving, the pure beauty of altruism, of that. So there's many different degrees and many different, but as was expressed, depending on what level we are, whether we're the spark, the flame, or the whole big picture of it. Yes.
Well, we were impressed by the statement realization. And the declaration said by self-induced and self-devised me. So the weight rests with me as I think I am. But then it dawned on me, and to use an example, that's a microphone. Well, we know that. Will I know what a microphone is by examining the microphone? Well, where do I have to go to understand what a microphone is? Will a microphone tell me anything at all? Then maybe realization may dawn. And that can open up a great deal of controversy in our present life. Is this real or that real? So we think that that's what our work on hand is all about, to show us how what we do not realize.
What we do not realize is very true, because it seems like if we look at the ideas of in each lifetime, we are expressing on this level that which we've already started, and now we're getting to actually work through, so that each lifetime, unless one at one point makes that effort to start to want to have this realization, to want to really understand who and what I really am, then it will be a longer time, because it seems like eventually situations will bring us to the point where we have to question. It just situation after situation, and depending how we go through any situation, our attitude of mind, our motive of mind, how we go through any situation is whether it's going to be balanced or not balanced. It would seem pure harmony within the universe and pure harmony within all mankind would be the basic answer. But we have to experience different situations till we get to the point where we understand it. Balance and harmony is the real norm, not what we go through. Too many of us go up and down with situations. We're indrawn in this, we're outdrawn in that. We vibrate too much, and we're too busy running and rushing that we don't feel that calmness, that silence that is within us. Yes?
Well, that's one of the definitions of karma. It's not only action, but it's an unerring tendency toward equilibrium. It ever seeks to balance out pairs of opposites to bring about justice in the world.
And we can start on this, shall we say, path anytime we wish. Now we understand it's one path, but for each individual, the way that they tread that path is theirs. But it is basically the one path, the one knowing. Yes?
One of the earlier questions was about intelligence, and we were thinking, we believe we've heard in these rooms that there is this oneness that was described. And perhaps one of the expressions of it would be universal intelligence, because if there is knowledge, there must be something that holds or knows all. So let's say there's this universal intelligence. Just like evolution, there must be grades of it as it is expressed. So part of what was just described, that process of realizing who we are engaging that intelligence faculty mm-hmm. that we all have. Brighter and more educated than the genius, but available to all of us. And as we apply our altruistic motives to it that were spoken of earlier, then we know we're heading in the right direction towards that harmony, towards that balance.
And that should give you at least a glimmer of, I can do this. I could do this. But it has to be taken, and for each individual, in steps, yes.
I think one of the previous comments, the questioner proposed the theosophical ideas as well as those of other Eastern teachers, and made the comment of not knowing which to believe. It's interesting that in studying theosophy, we are told not to believe anything.
Correct.
But rather approach it as a scientist would, to look for the operation of observable laws, test and check and verify those propositions on the basis of those laws. One of the laws being cycles, cause and effect. But the other very important one that science acknowledges is that of evolution. So obviously it can't be this eternal one self that evolves or changes or grows, because it's all encompassing. It can't be the personal self which dissolves at death. It has to be pointed out that individual soul or reincarnating ego, the thinker, the observer, that is ever capable of growing and evolving. And we think realizing that will help us decide for ourselves what is true and not having to believe what somebody says.
That idea of check and test and verify is very good. We have our limits in certain areas, but if something is true, it doesn't change. It's always the same. What was true 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, is still true today. For things that are constantly changing and moving, just in time alone, scientific, how often has it been where we add, well, man's been around longer, or it's been another century or whatnot. That's always changing about how long we've been around. And yet the ancient teachings have never changed. And a lot of the ancient teachings are really more Eastern ways of thinking, because the Easterner who has been, shall we say, involved in this at this time period, a lot of questioning that we'll have here in the West, they don't question. They just take it for granted, this is it, because of what's been in the past. What I'm going through now is very much similar to what was in the past. So they don't have the quarry that we have, and constantly, but it is a good thing to test and check it, because if we just use the three fundamental propositions of the philosophy, which comes from the dark of time in a way, if we could use those as our ruler to judge things, that would help us maybe understand. But the fact still comes down to, once something is true to us, there is nothing we have to hear, see, or read that's going to change the way we think. Because if it's true to us now, and it was true then maybe we've gained a higher level of understanding. Yes?
Just to follow up on that, though, we still have to be open-minded, though, and flexible on what we believe true. Because, yes, truth with a capital T, just like the self with a capital S, doesn't change. But there are relative truths. And we all know that what we once thought and were convinced to the very core of our being was true, we later realized was fanciful and foolish. And now we have another truth, but maybe in time that will change. So there's some aspect of truth that we have to be willing to be open to exploration.
Well, it would seem that's the checking and the verifying, and that's part of the growth process. Because we can all say, well, what I thought was true when I was a teenager, I look back and I'm thinking, how the heck did I even think that? Okay, that comes with application, with growth, a restatement. So it's not saying that you have to only see it in one light, but it is true. We do go through things, and it's part of the process. It's part of the evolution.
That definitely gets at what my next question is about, which is that it seems like there's two truths. Like, there's the truth that exists in this plane of existence, which is the small t, but that, by definition, changes all the time. And I think that the capital truth somehow is not something that we actually can know. I think that can be expressed in words, that anytime you try to express it in the forms that we're capable of, you're immediately getting away from what that truth is. And that's the part that really kind of pisses me off, is that there's this thing that I'm supposed to know, but there's something about it that is unknowable. And the truths in this world are, you know, always changing. So it's a very frustrating place to be.
And that is true. They are. The ones in this world are always changing. What we have now, we will not have when we re-enter again, shall we say. Different circumstances, different situations. There's just so much water you can put in a pitcher before it overflows. So it's just so much that one has to learn in any one lifetime that they can experience. Which makes sense in a way, because let's say you start on something and you're really working on it, and you want to get very good at it, disregard what it is. Look how much force and energy and will you put into doing that, that it seems logical at some point in time it will come forth and it will express itself. We always have a tendency to be, I want it yesterday. And if it doesn't cost a lot, it's not worth keeping. These are ideas that come with mankind today. Yes?
So the small t truth is relative. It's relative to what I believe at the moment,
right,
until what I believe at the moment falls apart or changes, and now I have to find a new relative truth. But the eternal truths are things like, I can prove I'm a spiritual being because I can imagine, and I can will, and I can choose. Those are not things my parents gave me at birth. Those are not, the fact that I can say I am, and everyone in the room can say the same thing and understand it, is a faculty that had to come from somewhere higher, because I didn't invent it, and I didn't get it from taking a class. All of the powers that we have of the mind and of the heart are those expressions of spirit that are able to come through on this changing plane, but they never change. So as was said, the eternal truths are those that do not change no matter what the conditions.
True, very true, yes.
Well, to explain the world outside of us, we have to explain the world within us. And if we want to prove anything to ourselves, we have to find that which is within us that doesn't change, that witnesses all the change. And when we recognize that there is something within me that's unchanging, we realize that same thing is in everyone else that's unchanging, that makes them the witness of all the change. So that's a truth, but it's a self-realized truth. And if one does not inquire and look into it and realize that the aphorism or the saying that we are a drop in that great ocean or a ray of that great sun, they will not realize their universal attachment to all of life, that profound conviction of universal brotherhood, because what lies within me lies within everyone.
And it's that I. It's that I. Can you actually think when I wasn't there? That's the one thing that we know, even from childhood. There is a time when the child stops talking in the third manner, like Johnny wants this, Johnny wants that. All of a sudden, at around the age of 7, I want that. I see that. That I comes in. That I has been with us all this time. There's been all the changes around us, within us, without us. That I is still here. And that I is what we're talking about. That I that goes on. Yes?
We heard the comment about the emphasized letter T's. And the effort made producing a physiological result related to our organic nature, and we smile. But if you go to the Bible, the Old Testament and the New Testament, and you can remember, that type of reaction is explained in a very colorful way to show you that because you are approaching, seeking, there are powers in the form that resist that. And here we learn exactly how to face up to that small self who resists every effort we make toward the understanding or the realization. To make the comment shorter, the Bhagavad Gita opens the the eyes and ears of many who hear it the first time.
Mm, true. In the back, you had your hand up.
Well, one thing, too, that we can look in the outer world to see about relative and absolute truth is that all we need to do is look at research that science does. I mean, we just heard within the last couple of weeks that you can kill yourself by taking calcium supplements. It's the whole idea of the egg. And in religion, there are people challenging the age-old dictates of the Catholic Church. So nothing in the outer world is definite. And like was said, you know, we have to turn inward and we have to see if there's truths that we are looking at. Do they cover the universal brotherhood? I mean, is that part of what that truth is? So we can't look at material truth as being absolute.
Yes.
In response to that comment, how can a person who's looking inward be sure that what they're seeing is absolute in the same way that, you know, maybe for a long time we thought calcium supplements were totally safe, and then we find out that they're, you know, we're able to kill ourselves with them. How do you protect yourself from the same way of knowing things inwardly? Isn't it possible to see things inside and be wrong about them?
That is very possible. But on the other hand, is that in connection with this? Okay, wait, we'll go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, the example for that probably could be seen in the scientific community, where an individual thinker, I was reminded this morning, might have a hypothesis, an educated guess, and then there's a lot of research and experimentation and observation done, then that's duplicated by other scientists who also try to run the same or similar trials, and eventually there's a theory that is proposed that appears to be a collective basis for thinking that appears to have solid reality, but even then it goes on and is open to other lines of research and new investigations and new information that might be brought to it. But it's a communal process, isn't it?
Hmm. So it could work in the same way when we start to look within. Now, sometimes we start to look within and we go, I don't see anything. I it's dark. As Mr. Judge said, the first few times you start to do it, it's like looking inside a glove. But you have to take the time to keep looking. In time, through the darkness, you could start to see things that becomes familiar to you. So you can use that scientific idea on things that you're going through within yourself. And there's other avenues that you can do too. But this whole idea of the real man, we are the perceivers. We are the ones that perceive things. We have to understand what we're perceiving, and that's going to take time. We have a couple closers here that we found that the source is, the goal is, and the path varies with the pilgrim. We thought that was very helpful. And it says, how can we recognize this power of acting from the basis of our eternal divine nature? By assuming our own divinity, by ceasing to place dependence on any philosophy or any science or religion or any statement whatever, by depending on the reality of that inner, truer spiritual, by clarifying our mental concepts, by thinking right thoughts, and by acting in accordance with them. We must open up these channels of our higher nature for ourselves. And remember, we are not creatures of circumstances. We are not creatures of our environment. We are their creators, the self. Thank you. That's it for the meeting. There. teenager, right?